This podcast is brought to you by Kyoto Japan Automotive Group, a company which I've known personally for over 20 years, and your one-stop shop for tires, batteries, and auto parts. Visit their website at www.kyotojap.com for more details. My guest today is Professor Xavier Oberson. He's Professor of Swiss and International Tax Law at the University of Geneva and partner at Oberson Abels, a law firm. Tax is our subject. We go back to the very beginning and talk about the origins of tax and what tax was used for, the turbulent history of public consent to pay taxes, the difference between avoidance and evasion, the politics of taxation and the Swiss way of taxation, and artificial intelligence, robots, and taxation in the future. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello, everyone. You'll certainly recall the words of Benjamin Franklin, the polymath and one of the founding fathers of the United States of America, who wrote, "But in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." You might not be so familiar with the words of George Bernard Shaw, the great Irish playwright, who wrote, "A government which robs Peter to pay Paul can always depend on the support of Paul." And Adam Smith, the Scottish 18th century economist and philosopher, he wrote the truism, "There is no art which one government sooner learns of another than that of draining money from the pockets of other people. All adults pay it, even infants in their cots benefit or are affected by it, and even in death we cannot necessarily escape it," as Benjamin Franklin said. Of course, I'm referring to taxes, and I'm devoting this program to taxes, and to do this complex subject justice, I've sought the help of a remarkable expert who is also an engaging advisor and very enjoyable conversation partner. For 30 years, he was professor of Swiss and international tax law at the University of Geneva, a graduate of Harvard Law School, a member of the Geneva Bar since 1987. He's also very, very well published, an innovator. He initiated and is the director of the recent LLM in tax at the University of Geneva. He's been appointed president of the Federal Experts Commission for the Reform of Tax Enterprises. I could go on. He's been a judge at the Federal Court of Appeal for Taxation for the past 15 years. And if he wasn't busy enough, among other things, he's also the vice president of the board of the foundation, the Montreux Jazz Festival, and president of the Montreux Jazz Artists Foundation. If you're Swiss, and particularly if you're based locally here in Geneva, you'll have guessed already that my guest is Professor Xavier Oberson of the firm Oberson and Abels. Welcome to the McKay interview, Professor Oberson. Xavier, if I may, thanks for inviting me to your offices here in the heart of Geneva.
Yes, welcome, Michael. Thank you very much.
It's good to see you again.
Yes, absolutely.
Xavier, I've been reading so much, as much as I could, about tax and taxation, and I quickly came to the view that we should only be able to scratch the surface in 30 minutes. But let's try our best to cover some of the salient points. My first question goes right back to the very beginning. Whose idea was it, to levy taxes? What was their motivation, and what was the impetus?
Yes, this is interesting. In fact, it seems that, we can trace tax back to around 5,000 years.
5,000 years?
Yeah, so it really started at the beginning of mankind in a way. And it seems that the first, sketches of a tax system were tribes, and they would keep part of the harvest to make offering to the gods. So it's like taking maybe a surplus of the harvest and keep it for the gods. And then eventually, these tribes evolved, and you started to have a lord or a chief of the tribe. And of course, eventually, the chief started to say, "Well, I want part of this money.
I like the revenue.
In a way, I'm some kind of god, you know. So I want to take part of that surplus." And this is really the beginning of taxes. And the sad aspect of that is that mostly it was used to finance war. So it was war between tribes, and in order to help funding defenses, arms, etc., they levied more and more of these taxes. At the beginning, it was more taxes on people, it was tax on goods, on harvest. So this was really the beginning of the tax.
So you told me what they were used for, a little bit of vanity and a little bit of war. Yeah. But tell me a little bit about what history teaches us regarding public resentment about having money taken from them Lord.
This is true. More and more people started, let's say, to complain about the scope, about the percentage, about the injustice among some taxes. For example, in the Middle Ages, you would have new powers emerging, like the church, you have the lords, and each of these powers, they wanted to levy the taxes for their own purposes. The church, it was to save the souls of people, and the lords, it was to protect the people. But if you combine all these taxes that were levied, for some people, it was almost impossible to survive. So they started to complain, and there are even some revolution. Take the British revolutions, the French Revolution of 1789, the War of Independence in the United States are also justified, not only, of course, but one of the main reasons often is the reason of is the cause of heavy and discriminatory taxes. In this period, so now I'm talking about, let's say, the French Revolution and the War of Independence in the US, you see this concept emerging, which are very important today, which are, for example, the principle of what we call no taxation without representation, which means you need a law. You should not have one person decided that you have to levy tax for him. It has to be the law. And now, even in Switzerland, we went further to say it has to be the law, plus it can be approved by the people with a referendum. And it shows this evolution as a way to, let's say, to balance the power and to make sure, in a way or another, the people can accept in advance the burden of taxes.
Yeah, I see. I just wanted to tell me again, in your experience.
And, by the way, an interesting part is that the inventor of the income tax is a prime minister of England.
It was. And why did he do that?
It was Mr. Pitt, famous.
Yeah.
William Pitt, exactly. Yeah. Earlier of the 18th century, and he drafted a sort of a complex tax reform with various options, and one of the options was an income tax, the sketches of the modern income tax that eventually everybody would adopt. So after that, it was Germany, France, and in Switzerland, we also adopted it. And again, here you see the link with the war. Because William Pitt, when he adopted
this is the
tax,
war against Napoleon.
It was the war against Napoleon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in Switzerland, it was, I think, if I recall, 1915. And it was even called, the first income tax in Switzerland, it was called, the law was called the tax on war. Can you imagine? So the tax on war. And it was supposed to be just 1 year tax. And it became, of course, let's say, general, and it was renewed every year. And today, this tax on war is the modern Swiss income tax. The federal income tax that we pay today was, in fact, the tax on war in 1915.
In 1815?
Yes.
Yeah, 1815.
It was the First World War.
Because of the First World War.
Yeah,
I see. Sorry, I got a little bit.
Yeah.
So from William Pitt, which was 100 years before that, fast forward 100 years to 1915.
Exactly.
I see.
For the Swiss, we took 1 year, yeah. 100 year to really adopt an income tax.
Okay. Well, maybe that's a good thing.
Yes.
Maybe that's a good thing.
Yes.
Tell me something. I wanted to ask you, because these are two words which are used very often, and I think sometimes a lot of people don't really understand the difference in the context of taxation, avoidance and evasion.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Yeah, it's you have some PhDs and conferences about this.
Really?
This
even now?
It's a subtle difference. I would say avoidance is that you design, or I would say a transaction, or you enter into a behavior in a way to pay the least tax possible. So this is tax avoidance, which, let's say, is more or less okay. I mean, if it is a tax planning, you have the right to design your affairs so that you pay the least amount of tax. There's even a Supreme Court judgment in the United States which has confirmed this. But already, if you go too far, for example, you still are on tax avoidance, but you start to do some artificial transaction, strange behavior, it can become what we call aggressive tax planning. And it's in many countries, this is already called tax evasion. It's not as such a crime, so you are not going to go to jail in most countries if you enter into that, but you can have a recharacterization of what you do, and you will have to pay the tax consequences. Then, difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance, this is the red line. So if your tax, let's say, avoidance is linked with dissimulation, so you hide facts to the tax administration.
So that's a nice word for lying, basically.
Yeah.
Dissimulation.
Dissimulation, lying. Yeah. Yes, so okay. You lie,
yes.
then you enter into, I would say, tax evasion. And even worse, this is a Swiss law concept, which is called tax fraud. In many countries, tax fraud, in a way, is a bit similar to tax evasion, frankly. But in Switzerland, you get even worse when you, for example, not only you lie to the tax administration, but you use some false document, forged document. And in this case,
to support the lie.
Yeah, yeah. And then even in Switzerland, this is even also a criminal offense.
But
you can even go to jail.
But something, you use the expression red line, which implies it is quite a strong line. But at the same time, particularly as you're a lawyer and an academic, that line must be discussed and negotiated.
Yes.
Is that, or am
totally.
I?
Totally. Yeah? This is the big problem. The line is not very clear.
Yeah.
You know, what is aggressive? Mm. Because it's a subjective concept.
Of course.
So, we tend to view the behavior of taxpayer today with our perspective, which has become much more critical. And I must even say that some behavior that were, let's say, not beautiful, but were in a way tolerated from the past, are now judged in a much more negative way. And the concept of aggressive tax planning has evolved and it now is interpreted very broadly. So now I always say you have really to be careful, try to do things properly. If you enter into some strange aspect, transaction, be careful because the tax administration may look at it as a aggressive tax planning. Which is, by the way, an interesting aspect of the Swiss tax policy, is that we have this possibility always to visit the tax administration.
Yes.
And it's a very pragmatic and it's a very proper way, I think, honestly, to implement a tax system. It's really part of our DNA. We very often go to see the tax administration.
I've done it myself. Yeah.
And you agree, it's not aggressive at all.
Yeah.
You have to disclose all the facts, of course, but then you can have what we call a ruling, which is a position from the tax administration, and you are protected under Swiss law by the so-called good faith principle.
Yeah.
And then everybody can sleep, and you know how you are going to be
done. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. My guest today is Dr. Xavier Oberson, Professor of Swiss and International Tax Law at the University of Geneva for the past 30 years, and we're talking about taxes and taxation. Tell me, Xavier, we can't have a conversation about taxation without addressing the politics of it.
Of course.
Now, as a student, a master, and a practitioner of taxes and taxation, share with me and our listeners your insights into how we broadly refer to left and right of the political spectrum, how they view this important area of government and governance,
right?
Left and right in politics.
So exactly. There's a there's a strong, let's say, opposition from a political standpoint about taxes. You are really two different worlds. And of course, I would say one extreme would be to say, in a way, it's a view of what the state should do.
Yeah.
You know, it's closely linked with the function of the state.
And the relationship between the state and the citizen.
Right. Yeah. So if you're on the left side, you would tend to say the state should take care of the people, should fight against discrimination. There's the concept of solidarity also, very strong on the left side. Which means we need a social security system. We not only should finance the defense, the war, as it was historically, as we spoke before, and therefore you need an important tax system, because you need a lot of money to finance this function of the state. And the recent vote in Switzerland was very clear on that. The proposal to add this 13 AVS social security rent was a proposal from the left. And it is this idea of solidarity and financing, in this case, the people in need, etc. If you go on the other spectrum, if you go to the right, then they would tend to say maybe the state should focus in police, in protection of the state, in some way to correct inequalities among the people, etc. But not go maybe too far, which means they need less taxes.
Yeah.
So this, I would say, it's very broad, the distinction between the left and the right. And of course, you have anybody in the middle, it's a very broad spectrum. What is interesting today is that we see, so this is the sketches of a tax system, and now you have some new perspective, for example, the ecological approach,
yes,
which in a way is a different perspective of the state, and they tend to say the state now should also try to correct and to reduce CO2 emission, to improve the sustainability of the system. And so what is interesting is what we see, new concept is of taxes. We do not fit so well between this distinction between left and right, which is an idea to use taxes as a way to correct, internalize social costs, etc., to reduce pollution. So which would be, in a way, a sort of a third concept between the left and between the right.
We're going to come back to that a little bit later in our conversation. But I just wanted, as we are in Switzerland, and as many of our listeners are in Switzerland, to spend a little time looking at what goes on here. There are three levels of administration, commune, cantonal, federal.
Yes.
How is this reflected in the taxes that are levied? And what can we discern about this country by viewing these three levels of taxation? Just give us some insights into that.
Yeah, this is in a way, it's a complex system, but I think it's a very fair, in a way, it's a very fair system, and I'm very much in favor of this federalism that we have in Switzerland. So the broad distinction in the past was, in a way, that the big indirect taxes were the competence of the Confederation, and you have the value-added tax, you have the custom duties, you have excise. All these taxes belong really to the Confederation. And the idea was that direct taxes, so taxes on income and taxes on wealth, belong to the cantons and the municipalities and the communes. But eventually, in 1915, with this tax on war, it was the first, let's say, direct federal taxes, which remained into force until today. So now we have a complex system where we have a direct federal income tax, which is levied by the Confederation, plus 26 direct income and wealth tax, which are levied by the canton.
And that, can I just stop you there? And that federal tax stays with the federal government, or is then redistributed amongst the cantons, or a little bit of both?
Yeah. So it's levied by the cantons. So the cantons are competent to levy also this federal income tax, but the proceed of this tax goes mostly to the Confederation. There's a little part which will go.
And that's for defense, for the railways?
Yeah, it's go to the budget. Yeah. It goes to the budget of the Confederation. So, yeah, defense, railway, social security, also for the budget of the state. What I just want to add is that for decades, we had this system, and it was very complex because some of the elements of these taxes were not always the same. You would even go to one canton and sometimes even the definition of income was not exactly the same as the definition of another canton. Can you imagine the problems and the planning, of course, that took place because of these differences? So eventually, in 2001, there was what we call a federal harmonization law, which is a very important legislation. It took 30 years to be adopted.
30 years.
Wow. Yes, 30. And there was no referendum, which is interesting. Yeah. Can you imagine such an important legislation? Which means that it was, in a way, very well drafted.
Yes.
And with a lot of compromise. So this federal law, since still today, defines in the same way all the essential elements, both of the federal income tax and all the cantonal. What remains to the competence of the cantons, of course, are the rates. So each canton for the cantonal income and wealth tax are completely free to design their rates, which explains why maybe it's better to live in Schwyz, which is the lowest income tax rate, than to live in Neuchâtel or in Geneva, where you have some higher tax.
I used to live in Zug when I first came here, and
exactly,
I remember that.
For example. But of course, you can view that from a different standpoint and say, well, you have a lot of infrastructures in Geneva, you have a cultural life, you have concert, you have opera, and then you get also something from your taxes
exactly.
in a way, as a return.
But maybe this is a bit of an unfair question to ask a professor of tax law. But are there any examples in Switzerland, in Switzerland now, where the government has got it wrong and maybe it's not gone according to plan, the taxes that were levied, or the administration didn't quite work out the way that the people making the initial plan had intended? Or generally speaking, do things go more or less smoothly and according to plan? I'm just interested to know.
Yeah, I cannot give you a clear example of people even, I mean, going on the street to complain about, I would say, inefficient or inappropriate use of taxes. And the reason is, I think, is that we have this principle of no taxation without representation, which is really applicable. And probably this is the country, I mean, Switzerland is the country where the people have the most power also regarding to tax. In other words, there are a lot of protection, I would say, against arbitrary or discriminatory use of taxes. And if there would be such a problem, we can always have like a referendum. If we see, for example, a draft legislation which doesn't make any sense, and we had a few, honestly, we had a few, we can even ask for a referendum and the people will vote. One interesting example, there was even a referendum about the dog tax,
really?
You know, the tax on dogs.
Yes.
And it was fascinating because you would see people on the street saying, I mean, we tax dogs, we should also tax the cat.
Yes,
you know?
Of course.
Isn't it an inequality of treatment? So you see these kind of issues.
Tell me, Xavier, I mean, I've lived here a long time, but is my memory correct that the Swiss voted against VAT quite a few times before they said
three times. Yeah. Totally, yes.
Yeah, three times.
Yes, it was the fourth vote which was the right one. So, the government desperately tried to introduce the value-added tax, which is the success story of the 20th century, a French invention, by the way. And there were three referendums that refused. And what is fascinating is that the last vote even the government, the federal, so the Conseil Federal, was so afraid that he even didn't dare to propose a value-added tax for the fourth time. So what he did, he brought a turnover tax, a sort of so-called modern turnover tax, which was not a value-added tax. And this is the parliament which suddenly said, no, we want a value-added tax. They brought it to vote, and then, to a big surprise, and it was more than 60%.
Passed by the parliament.
Passed by the parliament. And the Swiss people voted yes.
Let's step out of Switzerland for a while as we sort of come to the end of our conversation and look at supranational organizations and taxation. I want to know where Quo Vadis, where is it going? I mean, for example, the OECD, of which Switzerland is a founding member, going way back, is engaged in recommending supranational taxes in some areas. What are the pros and cons? And is the United Nations also involved in this? And how does that sit comfortably with taxation and representation? Give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a very important point. We see now a big development of supranational organization trying to recommend some kind of international tax system. The front runners right now are, of course, the OECD, and we see a clear implementation of this kind of supranational taxes with the so-called 15% minimum profit tax on some multinational entities. And we voted, by the way, I think we are the only country in the world, by the way, which voted on that topic, and it was accepted, I think, even more than 80% of the Swiss population.
I remember,
it was in June last year. So we see since January this implementation of this minimum 15% tax on some multinational entities. But the problem with that, of course, is that if you look at the draft of the parliament report from the Swiss chambers, it's all designed by the OECD. And from a democratic standpoint, from a no taxation without representation standpoint, there's a problem here, because we have very smart, very intelligent people at the OECD which design this system, frankly speaking, more and more complex. And this kind of participation of a representative of the population on the drafting of this rule is getting away.
So that's there must be a tension built into that system, particularly for a country like Switzerland, with its model of democracy, being part of, even a founding member of an organization which is initiating this kind of process.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a very delicate issue. Of course, I understand, on the other hand, that we are talking about global rules which would apply to China, to America, to Africa, to Europe. So we cannot have the Swiss people saying this is the way it should be done. I understand also, but we should find a way, and many people are thinking about that, to at least have the help, for example, of the parliament in the world. There are different approaches. Another approach which you mentioned is the role of the United Nations. Some people are thinking even about maybe a world tax organization where we would have more participation. I really don't believe that this is possible right now. But in a way, there's a sort of competition today between the United Nations and the OECD, especially also with the impetus of the developing countries, and I really understand that, think that maybe the OECD now has taken too much power in this area of international tax law.
Because these are mainly wealthy countries.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And they want to have the UN with more important roles, and we have seen recently some development in that direction.
Last question, Xavier. You touched very briefly at the beginning of our conversation on ecology. You used that word, but just briefly, and I know you've written a book on this recently, to just give us some insights into the rise of big data, of artificial intelligence, and of robots, of all things, and how that sits with taxation.
Yeah, I I've been doing a lot of research on that since a decade, I would say, and I published a book on that, so which was called Taxing Robots, and now there's a new one that is coming, which is called Taxing Artificial Intelligence. Personally, I've been very, very criticized on that, you can imagine.
You have been criticized?
Very much, especially when around 2017, when I started really to make conferences about this. But now I can see the evolution. The concept is pretty simple, frankly, is to say, I mean, we don't know where we are going with artificial intelligence. I'm not at all against artificial intelligence, but we should look at the consequences of it. And if the consequences are that people are losing more and more of their jobs, I mean, some people are even saying labor as such could even disappear, not right now, but maybe in 20 years or more. We don't have any base for the tax anymore.
Exactly.
We don't have a tax on salaries, for example. And we don't even have maybe the value-added tax because the consumption will go down. So we should think, it's a long-term process, but I think we should think about alternative. And one alternative, which I defended strongly, especially in this book, is to tax artificial intelligence. How do you do that? Well, there are many, many options that I recommend. For example, a sort of a theoretical salary, or some, or looking at the profit, at the value added of artificial intelligence. I mean, there are many ways. It's a long process, but it's a fascinating analysis, I think.
Thank you, Xavier. Thanks so much for helping me and everyone listening to understand these complexities. And clearly, as I said at the beginning, 30 minutes couldn't really do it justice, but I found our conversation most illuminating. My guest today has been Dr. Xavier Oberson, Professor of Swiss and International Tax Law at the University of Geneva. Thank you, Xavier.
Yes, thank you very much, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the McKay Interview podcast, brought to you by Kyoto Japan Automotive Group, a company which I've known personally for over 20 years, and your one-stop shop for tires, batteries, and auto parts. Visit their website at www.kyotojap.com for more details. And you can find more podcasts on Anchor FM. Just Google McKay Interview Anchor FM. Thanks again for listening.